theory of evolution was advanced by Charles Darwin in the middle of the 19th century. That period greatly differed from today in terms of its extremely poor level of science and technology. Nineteenth century scientists had to work in simple laboratories with quite primitive equipment. With the devices then available, it was impossible for them to view even bacteria. Furthermore, scientists were still under the influence of many superstitious beliefs upheld since the Middle Ages. One of these superstitious beliefs was that life had a simple form. Going as far back as Aristotle, this belief maintained that life could self-originate by the coincidental assembly of inanimate matter in a moist mallow. While developing his theory, Darwin relied on the belief that life basically had a simple structure. Other biologists who adopted and defended Darwin's theory thought the same way. For instance, the greatest advocate of Darwinism in Germany, Ernst Haeckel, supposed that the living cell, which could only be viewed as a dark spot under the microscopes at that time, had a very simple structure. In one of his articles, he referred to the cell as a simple little lump of albuminous combination of carbon. The theory of evolution was based on assumptions such as these. The pioneers of evolutionary theory, like Haeckel, Darwin, and Huxley, thought that life had a very simple form, and that this simple form could originate by itself as a result of chance. However, they were mistaken. One and a half centuries that have passed since Darwin's day, giant steps have been taken in science and technology. Scientists discovered the structure of the cell to which Haeckel referred as a simple little lump of albuminous combination of carbon. They saw with surprise that it is not simple at all, as earlier supposed. It was revealed that the cell has a system so complex as to have been unimaginable in Darwin's time.
A huge number of highly complex systems in nature cannot be plausibly accounted for.
A renowned molecular biologist, Michael Denton, makes the following analogy to describe what kind of a structure the cell has.
Exist in the biological literature.
To grasp the reality of life as it had been revealed by molecular biology, we must magnify a cell 1,000,000,000 times, until it is 20 kilometers in diameter and resembles a giant airship large enough to cover a great city like London or New York. What we would then see would be an object of unparalleled complexity and adaptive design. On the surface of the cell, we would see millions of openings, like the portholes of a vast spaceship, opening and closing to allow a continual stream of materials to flow in and out. If we were to enter one of these openings, we would find ourselves in a world of supreme technology and bewildering complexity. Now let us vitalize Professor Denton's spaceship analogy and see the complexity in the cell closer. Our journey starts with hormones that look for an appropriate cell for themselves. Approach the cell, they first look for a door that will let them in. The doors of the cell are selected in the way they operate. Every molecule stopping by a door is checked by the door to see whether it is beneficial to the cell or not. The doors open only for useful molecules. If a harmful material, such as a virus, tries to enter a cell's door, the situation changes. The cell door analyzes the material, finds out that it is harmful, and rejects it. When we enter the cell, we discover, as Professor Denton describes, a stunning technology and complexity. Immediately taken under control by special proteins that carry out the functions of the cell. These proteins are called enzymes. If required, enzymes immediately put the newly arrived hormones to use. If there is no need for these hormones at that moment, they are placed in the storage compartment of the cell, which is called the Golgi apparatus. Some molecules, such as the insulin that carries sugar molecules, are too big to pass through the doors of a cell. The cell has a specially designed system for such big but useful molecules. The cell extends a special appendage outside its membrane to admit the insulin. The insulin outside is pulled in by this appendage. Of course, there's no need to say that a strict security check is not forgotten. Once inside, special carrier enzymes carefully collect the sugar molecules on the insulin. Enzymes convey the sugar molecules they receive from insulin to the mitochondria, which makes up the cell's power-generating plant. The duty of mitochondria is to break down the energy-containing molecules it receives and process them so that they can be used by the cell. Produced as a result of very complicated reactions in the mitochondria, the ATP energy packs are transferred to the related compartments of the cell through, again, a perfect mechanism. Special channels, called endoplasmic reticulum, handle the transportation in the cell. The nucleus, which resembles a gigantic information processing center, is the brain of the complex system of the cell. Inside the cells are chromosomes, each of which is a huge databank. Chromosomes consist of intertwined DNA chains. The detailed plans of all the systems in the cell are coded in these DNA chains. A DNA chain is like a spiral helix composed of the sequential arrangements of four different molecules. These four different molecules are actually an alphabet of four letters. Thanks to this alphabet, an enormous amount of information that would fill hundreds of volumes of an encyclopedia is coded in the DNA molecules. This coding system includes the detailed production plans of the thousands of different enzymes and proteins used in the cell. The projects of all organic molecules that will be structured in the cell are written in the DNA down to their smallest details. production of an organic molecule, such as a protein, starts with the identification of the gene containing the required information among the DNA found in the chromosomes. An enzyme exclusively in charge of this task opens the DNA like a zipper. Then, another group of enzymes come and divide the DNA strands into two. Another enzyme goes over one of the split pieces and quickly reads and copies the data coded here. Now, a perfect copy of the production plan in the DNA is obtained. After replication is completed, enzymes close the DNA and restore it to its original state. The copy produced from the DNA is called messenger RNA. Messenger RNA contains the production plan of the protein required for the cell. Protein production itself takes place in another part of the cell. This structure, which we can also call the factory of the cell, is the ribosome. There is a perfect system of production in the ribosome. Messenger RNA slips in from one end of the ribosome and slowly proceeds. In the meantime, conveyors called the transfer RNA molecules carry the amino acids, which are the components required for the protein to be produced, to the ribosome in a complete state and in the right sequence. The amino acids brought here combine in the right sequence thanks to the code on the messenger RNA. As the messenger RNA proceeds, the amino acid that corresponds to the data coded there is added to the chain. The result is a new protein. The slightest mistake in the amino acid sequence would cause the protein that is produced to be useless. Yet, such mistakes almost never happen. Production complete, the protein leaves the ribosome to set out for its duty. Extraordinary processes take place, not somewhere far away, but right on your own body. The events we have simplified here are actually far more complicated, and they are continuously repeated in each and every one of the 100 trillion cells in your body. The cell, which was thought to be a simple little lump of albuminous combination of carbon by the formulators of the theory of evolution, has such an extraordinary design. This magnificent system certainly could not have emerged by chance, as the theory of evolution claims. When all these details of cell biology were revealed and understood, the theory of evolution suffered a great blow. Today, many of the world's distinguished scientists acknowledge that life, as embodied in the living cell, cannot be a product of chance. A very superior design underlies all aspects of life. One of these scientists is Michael Behe, an acclaimed American professor of biochemistry. He refers to the fact of design in the cell as revealed by modern science as follows.
I think the conclusion of design is a scientific one, an empirical one, based completely on the observable system the universe and life were intended, that they are the product of intelligent activity. And I'd just like to point out that this idea comes from the progress of science. It is not from not what we do not know, but is rather from what we have learned over the past 50 years.
Indeed, science shows that all living beings have been brought into being as a result of conscious creation. Failing to explain the complex systems in a single living cell, the theory of evolution also fails to explain the designs in the bodies of living things. For instance, the aerodynamic in a bird wing, the amazing hunting methods of a spider. An insect made to resemble a leaf so that it can camouflage itself. The eye design on a butterfly's wings. Or the feeling of compassion in animals. Life, with all its details perfectly designed, is obviously the result of superior creation. That superior creator is the Almighty God, the Lord of the heavens, the earth, and everything in between. When you look around you, out in open air and in a broad field, you can readily see all objects farthest and closest to you in all their colors, shapes, and size. This view, which you have obtained without making any effort, is produced as a result of numerous complex reactions and interactions in your body. Now, let us look at these complicated operations closer. The human eye has a fully automatic mechanism that works perfectly. It is made up of the combination of 40 different basic parts, and all these parts have critical functions in the process of seeing. Any defect or disability in even one of these parts would make seeing impossible. The transparent layer in the front part of the eye is cornea. Right behind lies the iris. Giving the eye its color, the iris adjusts its size automatically according to the sharpness of light, thanks to the muscles attached to it. For example, if we are in a dark place, the iris widens to take in as much light as possible. When light increases, it shrinks to decrease the amount of light coming into the eye. The automatic adjustment system in the iris works like this. The moment light comes into the eye, a nerve impulse travels to the brain and gives message about the existence and brightness of the light. The brain immediately sends back a signal and orders how much the muscles around the iris will contract. Another eye mechanism working parallel to this structure is the lens. The duty of the lens is to focus the light coming to the eye onto the retina layer at the back of the eye. Thanks to the movement of the muscles around the lens, light rays coming to the eye from different angles and distances can always be focused on the retina. All the systems we have mentioned are far smaller, yet far more superior to the mechanical devices designed by the use of the latest technology in order to imitate the eye. Even the most advanced artificial imaging system in the world remains extremely simple and primitive compared to the eye. When we think of the effort and knowledge that has been put into developing these artificial imaging systems, we can understand with what a superior creation the eye is made. If we examine a single cell in the eye at the microscopic level, the superiority of this creation will be further revealed. Let us suppose that we look at a crystal bowl full of fruit. The light rays coming from this bowl to our eye pass through the cornea and iris and are focused on the retina by the lens. So, what happens in the retina so that the retinal cells can perceive light? When light particles, also called photons, strike the cells in the retina, they produce a cascading effect like a row of dominoes carefully arranged one after the other. The first of these dominoes in the retinal cells is a molecule called 11-cis-retinol. When a photon of light interacts with it, this molecule changes shape. This forces a change in the shape of another protein, rhodopsin, to which it is tightly bound. Now, rhodopsin takes such a form that it can stick to another protein called transducin, which was already present in the cell, but with which it could not interact before due to its shape's incompatibility. After this union, another molecule called GDP also joins in this group. Now, two proteins, rhodopsin and transducin, and a chemical molecule called GDP have bound together. However, the process has just begun. The compound called GDP now has the proper form to bind to another protein called phosphodiesterase, which always exists in the cell. After this bonding, the shape of the molecule that is produced would trigger a mechanism that will start a series of chemical reactions in the cell. This mechanism changes the ion concentration in the cell and produces electrical energy. This energy stimulates the nerves lying right at the back of the retinal cell. Consequently, the image that came to the eye as a photon of light sets on its journey in the form of an electrical signal. This signal contains visual information about the object outside. In order for seeing to take place, the electrical signals produced in the retinal cell have to be transmitted to the center of vision in the brain. Nerve cells, however, are not directly connected to one another. There is a tiny gap between their junction points. How then does the electrical stimulus continue on its way? At this point, another set of complex operations takes place. The electrical energy is transformed into chemical energy without any loss of the information being carried, and in this way, the information is transmitted from one nerve to the next. The chemical carriers located at the junction points of nerve cells successfully convey the information contained in the stimulus coming from the eye from one nerve to another, When transferred to the next nerve, the stimulus is again converted into electrical signal and continues its way until it reaches another junction point, making its way to the center of vision in the brain. In this way, the signal is compared to the information in the center of memory and the image is interpreted. Finally, we see the bowl full of fruit, which we viewed before. By virtue of this perfect system, made up of hundreds of small details, and all these amazing operations take place in a fraction of a second. Moreover, since the act of seeing takes place continuously, the system repeats these steps over and over. For example, the molecules playing a part in the chain reaction in the eye are restored to their original state every time, and the reaction starts all over again. Of course, at the same time, many other equally complex operations are taking place in other parts of the body. We may simultaneously hear the sound of the image we are viewing. And depending on circumstances, we may sense its odor and taste and feel its touch. Meanwhile, millions of other operations and reactions have to continue without interruption in our body if we are to go on living. Primitive science of Darwin's day knew about none of this. Despite that, however, even Darwin realized the extraordinary design in the eye and confessed his despair in a letter he wrote to Asa Gray on April 3, 1860, in which he said, "The very thought of the eye makes me cold all over." The biochemical properties of the eye that have been discovered by modern science dealt a greater blow to Darwinism than Darwin could ever have imagined. The complete process of seeing that we have summarized in barest outline here is even more complex in its details. However, even this summary is enough to show what a glorious system has been created in our body. The reactions taking place in the eye are so complex and so finely tuned that it is quite unreasonable to think that these are a product of chance occurrences, as the theory of evolution claims. Michael Behe, a recognized professor of biochemistry, makes this comment on the chemistry of the eye and the theory of evolution in his book, Darwin's Black Box. It is longer enough for an evolutionary explanation of that power to consider only the anatomical structures of whole eyes, as Darwin did in the 19th century. Each of the anatomical steps and structures that Darwin thought were so simple actually involved staggeringly complicated biochemical processes that cannot be papered over with rhetoric. But, as we have seen, the theory of evolution is unable to account for a single system in a single living cell, much less explain life as a whole. Having utterly demolished the hypothesis that life is simple, science demonstrated to humanity a very important fact. Life is not the product of unplanned happenings. It is the result of a perfect creation. The perfect creation of a superior creator who brought life into being, who is God, the Lord of all the worlds. It is He who created both humans and all other living beings, and man is responsible to his Lord who created him. God reminds man of his truth in the Quran. It is He who has created hearing, sight, and hearts for you. what little thanks you show. They said, "Glory be to you. We have no knowledge except what you have taught us. You are the all-knowing, the all-wise."